The Human Service Finance and Policy Committee will come to order, and Chair Knorr would like to move the minutes for March 12, 2026. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes for March 12, 2026? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted from Thursday, March 12, 2026. First on the agenda for today is House File 4110, Representative Zelenskar. I will move that House File 4110 be re-referred to the Committee on Workforce, Labor, Economic Development, Finance, and Policy. Representative Zelenskar, we have the bill in front of us. Welcome to the committee.
Well, happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm in green, St. Patrick's Day. Members, and today this House File 4110 is really a common sense bill for a good intention that was passed, but this establishes an exemption to the new meal and rest break requirements for staff who work independently with vulnerable adults or children. And staff who work with vulnerable adults are required to respond to emergencies at all times, depending on the individual's scheduled or unscheduled needs, to provide support for them around the clock. And so during shifts, employees will respond, they will take informal rest opportunities during the natural pauses during low intensity times in healthcare. And that's been around since I started in healthcare at 16. And for the 40 years I was in operation, that was a common standard of practice. And while they're waiting for residents or tenants to need other care and supervision. So allowing a 15-minute rest and a 30-minute off-the-clock break really puts the health and safety of vulnerable adults who have are in situations where they're on one-on-one care, compromises their safety. And I don't think that's the intent of what we wanted to do in the legislation. So this is a common sense solution. It's got bipartisan support to ensure quality of care and to protect our vulnerable adults that receive 24-hour care. Chair Schumacher, I would like to introduce my guest to further explain this bill and the intent of it.
Ms. Grafstrom, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, members of the Human Service Committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Grafstrom, Senior Director of State and Federal Policy at ARM. Our members provide 245D licensed residential services to individuals on one of the four disability waivers. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 4110, allowing for an exemption from the new meal and rest break requirements for employees who are working alone and supporting vulnerable adults. I've had the opportunity to be in front of this committee many times talking about the services our members provide. The individuals our members support in community residential settings require a 24-hour plan of care, with many requiring 24-hour direct supervision. The staffing model for most homes is one staff member supporting anywhere from 1 to 4 residents over an 8-hour shift. The meal and rest break standards that were passed in the last session require a 15-minute break for every 4 hours worked and a 30-minute unpaid off-the-clock meal break for every 6 hours worked. This could jeopardize the safety and well-being of the individuals our members support and is inconsistent with state requirements to provide 24-hour support when needed. Here are a couple examples of when the break requirements would be challenging to meet. Our staff regularly provide one-to-one support for individuals outside of their homes. Staff are responsible for accompanying individuals to medical appointments, on vacation, or to other activities where the person cannot be left alone, so the staff cannot take a break. Another example is during the overnight hours. Homes will usually have one staff person who is either asleep or awake, depending on the needs of the individuals in the home. Staff are expected to be able to respond to emergency situations that may occur and cannot be relieved of duties for a 30-minute break each evening. Or a community residential home where one staff will be present to provide support and services to anywhere from 1 to 4 individuals. I want to make sure to highlight that while staff are expected to be able to respond to emergency situations during an entire shift, there are still opportunities for downtime, restroom breaks, and time to eat. Often staff cook meals with the individuals they support and share them together. The goal of House File 4110 is to narrowly tailor an exemption to recognize the unique and critical work our staff is responsible for and to ensure that the health and safety needs of the individuals they are supporting are met at all times. Thanks for the time today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, as a member, Buck McAlpin, representing the Minnesota Ambulance Association. Surprisingly, we noticed this bill the other day. We've been looking for a little solution, mostly in regards to our rural ambulance services. And what we've been looking for is Minnesota Statute 144E requires an ambulance to be staffed and available to respond 24/7. Although the brake law hasn't had a big implication to the larger ambulance services. They've been able to work that out within union contracts and other things. Those ambulances may have 15 or 20 vehicles on at a time. There is a definition in federal law under the word emergency response here, and we appreciate Representative Zelesnikar putting this bill together because, well, Representative Backer, you're probably the best example. You have one ambulance in Browns Valley, and you can't really shut your radio off for 15 minutes and not be available if you were on shift for break time. And what this would allow us to do, Mr. Chair and members, is not have our ambulance requirement statute conflict with the break law rule statewide, basically, for what we do in the ambulance industry. So we appreciate the support with this and the conversation.
Thank you, Mr. McAlpin. Next we have Nicole Mattson and Shelley Bakken. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimonies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shelley Bakken, and I'm here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative, a collaboration between Care Providers of Minnesota and Leading Age Minnesota, representing more than 2,000 long-term care providers across the state. First, we want to thank Representative Zelesnikar for bringing this bill forward today. This bill recognizes an important reality in long-term care and other healthcare settings. Our providers operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, caring for vulnerable adults who rely on us for their safety and well-being. The logistics of staffing and scheduling in these environments can be complicated by circumstances outside of anyone's control. Weather events, staff illness, last-minute call-ins, and other unexpected disruptions. We heard from small providers, for example, that when only a limited number of staff are on duty, managing resident transfers or assisting residents with immediate needs can make uninterrupted break times challenging. This bill provides important flexibility in those situations. Providers prioritize breaks for employees not just because it's the law, but because it is the right thing to do for employees. It allows staff time to rest and reset during demanding work. But despite the best planning and best intentions, there are times when the immediate needs of residents must come first. I'll now turn it over to my colleague to continue our testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nicole Mattson, also with the Long-Term Care Imperative. In my previous role, I was a long-term care administrator, and I can speak firsthand how scheduling is just a game of Jenga. You make your best attempts and always try to do what's right, but there are circumstances that interrupt your day. When situations arise where staff need to step in to ensure that residents are safe, even if that means delaying or shortening a break in that moment, caregiving doesn't happen on a predictable schedule. Resident needs simply don't pause because the clock says that it's time for a break. Another reality is that long-term care staff are responsible for continuity of care at all times, and regulations require providers to maintain appropriate supervision and respond immediately when residents ask for assistance. In practice, this means that staff must be able to prioritize a resident who needs help right away, whether it's assisting with mobility or answering a call light or helping with another request or a concern. House File 4110 provides limited and practical flexibility so that providers are not penalized in situations where staff must respond to the needs of the residents in their care, particularly when there may be only one staff person present or when immediate care cannot be delayed. And we appreciate the bill's recognition of the operational realities of care settings and its effort to balance employee protections with the responsibility to ensure that vulnerable adults remain safe. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Bakken and Ms. Mattson. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 4110? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Member questions? Chair Norm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill forward, Representative Lesnicker. This is about continuity of care, but I just wanted to walk through the process. Mm-hmm. So let's say you've got 6 hours and you end up using your 30 minutes break and your 15 minutes break. Or if this bill goes forward, are you going to lose your breaks because now you have to quickly come back to work and you're exempt from that reporting process?
Representative Salinas-Lacar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question, Rep. Noor. The reality, having worked in 24-hour operations for 40 years, the reality is the staff are amazing in these settings to triage their care needs. They know. They, having been at an aid level, I did the same thing. You know your people who are sliding scale insulin, who have brittle diabetics, you have medication timing that you have to do, and then you have the things you can't plan for. A fall, the ambulance is coming, somebody pulled a fire alarm. But I can tell you that in settings that do care, what the team works together every day, and then they're able to match that. So when the residents are laying down, that's when they tend to take that at common sense times, not in prescriptive times. Because if you don't have the flexibility in healthcare, then we are in conflict with the statutes that this body's also passed that mandate care, how often you're going to toilet somebody, how often you're going to do meals. Meals are supposed to be served warm. There's all kinds of contradictory regulatory language that are in the statutes that don't allow flexibility then, so we're at odds with it. So I would say that both things can be true when there is flexibility at the site to respond to the emergencies, and then everybody uses the restroom. I did, and in the facilities I've worked in and visited, that I've never had anybody tell me that doesn't happen. And so, and many of these people have, we have worked hard to get person-centered care. They're eating together. They're shopping together. In the home care model and in a disability group home model, they're shopping together. They're at the store together. And so you would never leave a vulnerable adult. And in a setting that is a facility setting, like a nursing home and assisted living, you have a responsibility first and foremost. And anybody that's in healthcare knows that. The resident comes first, and then we triage the timing. So it might not be 10 o'clock, it might be 11, it might be 11:15, and we all do that. So you'll see staff sometimes sitting in the hall, they might be on their cell phone taking care of personal affairs, or they might be charting. But they have the flexibility to do what they need to do, and the restrooms are out throughout the facility, and then and same with eating. So I don't see it as being an issue at the sites, and the testifiers may have another comment too.
Ms. Grafstrom.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Schumacher, Chair Noor. I would just point out that within the proposed legislation, there is language that says an employee must still be allowed the time to use the restroom, must still be allowed time to eat a meal. It's just the challenge that we have with the law as written is that requirement for the 30-minute or the 50-minute off the clock, where you are not responding to emergencies. You are not there in case something happens to the individual that you're supporting.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So for that instance, let's say you've got a 6 hour that you're supposed to be providing services. You never took the 30-minute break. You never took the 15 because you were providing continuity of care. How will that be billed for services when you look at this person has not been given that the break that was already included in there? Are they going just to receive? Are we excluding that the paid 30 minutes that they should have had, the 15-minute break that they should have had because they provided continuity of care for 6 hours straight out the process because they were responding to a situation.
Ms. Grafstrom.
Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, and I apologize if I'm not understanding the correction or the question, but staff are paid for their entire shift. There's no time that they're not paid during if they're not taking a break.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I should paraphrase, you know, because I'm looking at this from the perspective that the exemption is under 177.253 and 177.254, which requires the 15-minute break and also the 30-minute paid for that individual, for instance, if they're working 6 hours in a day. So for an instance that I'm providing the care, and there's a need for that continuity of care because there should not be a cycle of break because you're responding to a crisis after crisis, helping, making sure that you're supporting the patient. What happens in that instance whereby that employee who's entitled to the break time is no longer getting that break time? So are they going to get additional funding for that? Or are we just going to say that it's because it's part of the continuity of care, that you don't get paid for that 30-minute break that you're entitled to, which is lunch break, and that 15-minute break that you missed because you are continuing to provide that care?
Ms. Grafstrom. Yeah. Representative Salonsalikar.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher, and thank you for the question, Rep. Knorr. I can tell you from experience of working side-by-side with staff for my entire career before coming here and in many settings, in the cities and in rural Minnesota, what you're describing, the reality is that there is ebbs and flows in the time. In a six-hour shift, when I was a CNA, and it hasn't changed today in the care models, there are times when you're able to take your break, but prescriptively, it doesn't work in the model of care. You cannot leave vulnerable adults in these models. So they triage it. You know, they might be shopping at the store in that 6 hours, and when they come back, then they're able to do it. So it's not like it's stacked up. Every single minute is just that intense where you're never going to be able to go to the bathroom. That's not how it works. But it's not a desk job. This is not a situation where you can, you know, it's not comparing apples to apples. So we need to be mindful that the settings across Minnesota are, we have four people in a house. We have many models of care that this body has worked for years to get person-centered care and community-based living. And so the models that exist allow for the flexibility for the people to have the breaks, but with something like this where you're stepping out of a facility, you would not do that. You would not step outside of a facility for 15 minutes and leave a vulnerable adult. And so that model that you're describing, that's what this is about, is making sure that vulnerable adults are not in that position. And so the breaks and the meal times would be able to have flexibility to happen, and I believe that that is exactly how sites are operating.
Chair Knorr.
My final question, Mr. Chair. So if there's already a labor agreement that has already been reached with a labor union, will this change impact that contract?
No.
Ms. Grafstrom.
Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, none of our members are represented by the labor union, so I don't have the answer to that question.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things I was hoping to hear as part of the presentation of this bill, I did not. We heard from administrators, business owners, but we didn't hear from workers about what their experiences are when it comes to breaks. I've worked in healthcare, in human services. I think my first job was as a PCA. And as we've heard today, not all places of employment are the same. Whether it's one person that's being cared for or four, it doesn't mean that every house that has four people in it is the same. I can tell you that I know that there are times where workers for the entirety of their shift don't have time to take a break. And so this idea where all employers are going to be altruistic, all employees are going to just magically be able to have a break, I don't believe. I do think that you're right the majority of the time that workers will find those natural pauses to be able to take a break, to eat a sandwich, go to the bathroom, whatever it is. I think in most cases that is true. But where my concern with this specific piece of legislation is what about those outliers, those times where workers don't get that chance to take a break? That's my concern, is because we're taking away any guardrail for them to be able to take care of themselves in those more challenging situations. And that's what I don't like about this. And to Chair Knorr's point, in those times, on those shifts where workers do not get a chance to take a break, are they going to get an extra 30 minutes of pay or something like that because they weren't given a break? Are they going to be compensated in any way for not being allowed time to take a break? That's my question.
Representative Zielinski-Carr.
Chair Schumacher.
Ms. Grafstrom.
Representative. So I agree. I think staffing challenges are something that we have been in front of this committee for many years talking about. I wish that we had two staff for every home, or, you know, the more direct care available. And I think we are going to continue to advocate to you and to the legislature to support our work in making sure that we can compensate our staff and keep our staff and not have the turnover and make sure we have enough staff so we don't have those situations where employees are supporting a vulnerable adult and don't have the additional staff support to take those really much needed breaks. I completely agree with you. To your question about the meal break, so as it's written right now, the 30-minute meal break is uncompensated if a staff takes that right now. Without this break, they are paid the entire time. So there's no time during their shift that they are not compensated, where if they take the 30-minute meal break, it's uncompensated.
So, Representative Frederick, is your question more on the lines of if they don't get the unpaid break, even though they're getting paid for that time, do they get an additional amount of time?
Anything, any sort of compensation, anything, Mr. Chair. I want to make sure that we are keeping the worker's perspective in mind as part of this conversation, because I can understand overwhelming majority of the time what the picture being painted, I believe, is accurate. I think it's fair. I just want to make sure that we are also being intentional about those outliers as well in those more challenging situations, that that's also part of the conversation.
Okay, so if I'm hearing, and sorry for interjecting myself in this, I'm not used to that part of it. You're looking at that, say an employee didn't get their 30-minute unpaid break, they got paid for that time, but you would see the 30-minute as uncompensated, as part of the benefits that they have, and so there should be some kind of...
Something.
Okay. I think that's where some of the lines have been crossed with that.
Ms. Grafstrom. Chair Schumacher, Chair Frederick, I think... You know, we know we have technical assistance coming from the Department of Labor. We want to work with everyone on this bill to make sure it feels comfortable for folks. So I'm happy to have more conversations about what else you would like to see to make sure that we are ensuring that staff are taken care of.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just my last comment on this. This is a more broad-based exemption across the board, so it touches every care or vulnerable adult, you know, services that are being provided. And I wanted to put into perspective, I don't know if the nonpartisan staff will assist us on the collective bargaining question under the labor 177.253. Mr. Chair.
Ms. Pinelli.
Mr. Chair and members, the underlying statute that governs the work and the meal breaks already includes some language related to collective bargaining. Just saying that there's nothing in this section that prohibits employers and employees from establishing rest breaks or meal breaks that are different from those provided in this section pursuant to a collective bargaining agreement.
Mr. Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to underline that. So there's already a safeguard there, which means those who are not in any collective bargaining, they also need to have their, their protection somehow within this bill. Thank you.
Any other questions for the bill author? Final word, Representative Zelenslikar.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher, and thank you, members. You know, I hear the concerns that have been raised and understand what it is. I think the most important thing, there's two things to remember. It's important that we take care of the employees. I've been the employee in many of these settings, as many of you probably have too. And also to make sure that we're not in conflict of protecting vulnerable adults. And two things can be true, and I think both of them are equally a priority. And that's something that I have worked hard my entire career before retiring to get that done. And these models of care need the flexibility to adjust for that. And so what this is really saying is you're not going to walk out of a facility or a home to leave the facility. You're going to be inside it so that you can be available. It doesn't mean you're not going to have rest or be able to use the restroom or have meals, because person-centered care is what we've been doing. So many facilities pay the entire 8-hour shift. And so the 8 hours pay is happening, and then the flexibility is going on, because that's what they've had to do before this bill even took place, where the language was changed. And so that's common practice in a lot of facilities right now. And unfortunately, we can't always legislate for the outliers. I think the majority of people do what's right, and then on isolated and situations that are not, they have to be addressed to make sure that it's balanced in the right way. But really the intent of this is to make sure we don't have vulnerable adults in a situation where their care plan and their ability to have essential safety services can't be met. Where the intent of this isn't to not have the employees have meal time and to have rest. It's just they're not going to be walking out of the facility to leave people vulnerable. They're going to be able to have their rest and their bathroom breaks and their meal time. So I would urge members to vote yes for this. I think it's a common sense compromise that's very understood in healthcare settings by healthcare teams. Thank you.
With that, I will renew my motion that House File 4110 be re-referred to the Committee on Workforce, Labor, Economic Development, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion passes, and House File 4110 is re-referred to the Committee on Workforce, Labor, Economic Development, Finance, and Policy. Thank you, Representative Zelenslikar. Next, we have House File 4101, Representative Schultz. As he makes his way forward, I will move that House File 4101 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Schultz, your bill is in front of us. Welcome to the committee. I understand you have an amendment, the A2 amendment.
I do, Mr. Chair. That's
I will
amendment.
Move the A2 amendment. Representative Schultz, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Co-Chair Knorr and committee. This morning we'll be talking about periodic data matching and the reports that are required to the legislature. This sunsets in January 1st of 2027, and so our goal is to remove that sunset and also to ensure that we are getting this report as the legislature. This has been a constant struggle for us, and so the A2 amendment speaks to our goal to ensure that we have some enforcement mechanisms so that the report are delivered to the legislature.
All right, to get the bill into the form that the author wishes to present, Chair Knorr.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to get a clarity on the A2 amendment, because it looks like there's a penalty here of 10% reduction of the operating fund of a fiscal year, which is significant, 10% of the 3% that we're giving to the agency just simply because of a report. Is that where we are today?
Yes.
Wanted to ask that question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Co-Chair Knorr. When we think about the challenge that the legislature has had, we need to have enforcement mechanisms in place to ensure that we are getting the reports. across state agencies, it is well known that reports are required to be delivered to the legislature so that we can make good decisions with the taxpayers' dollars. And to this point, this has been a significant issue during the last several years of the Walz administration, while we've experienced $9 billion worth of fraud. And so my goal with this is to ensure that we are getting this report to the legislature that has been in statute, that has not been to the been delivered to the legislature, especially in the last 2 years. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Norris.
Mr. Chair, I find it troubling that we're looking into punitive process for something I think that is really simple to make sure that we get the data that we want from the agency. I don't know if any members read all the reports that we've been getting, because we've been receiving tons of reports from the agency. I can talk about the underlying issue, but then this amendment actually introduces additional steps that are not necessary for us to achieve the goals that we want. If it's about report process and getting periodic data matching, that's a different conversation. But when you introduce that we're going to be penalizing the agency, those hardworking staff who are able to get us what we need, because everyone who's working within the department will be impacted. And this is not how we do business here. The punitive 10% reduction of the operating expenses that we're including in here is beyond the normal process. That's why I'm trying to make sure that people understand what the amendment states, rather than just talking about the underlying bill.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Co-Chair Knorr, it's extremely concerning to me that this report is in state statute yet has not been delivered to us as the legislature. And so I think every member of this legislature needs to be concerned about how we are delivering reports that are mandated by state statute to members of the legislature. And so I don't know what tools and mechanisms you have gone about doing to ensure that the agency is doing what you have placed into law, Mr. Chair. This is one mechanism, and I trust that the expertise around this table is going to get us to the place where we have the appropriate mechanisms to hold this administration accountable for failing to adhere to the law.
Mr. Chair, I'll ask the members to vote no, because this is a significant shift to a normal process whereby we can hold the agency accountable. If we're not getting the report, we can talk about the underlying bill. But this is coming up with a significant punitive process is not the way we do business here.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I am going to oppose the comments that Chair Noor has said. Taxpayers are constantly asking us to hold the administration accountable. And I think it's about time that we do penalize them. What are the recourse now when they don't hand us a report? Oh, I guess we can take that offline. We can talk about that offline. There's absolutely no teeth in our legislation because they're not punished. They're not held accountable. They can just not do the reports. We're not given the information, and more bad actors and thieves are stealing our money. I do think that this is a great amendment, and I can't wait for us to vote for it.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. I'm a little frustrated that we keep having to come back to committee and talk about why we write laws and where the funding actually goes when we commit money to people. What your amendment essentially does, while you intend to penalize the administration, the funds that the legislature approves are to ensure that the people entrusted in our care receive not only the services that they need to survive, but that they are receiving the services provided by the employees of the department and the department itself to ensure that all of the licensing provisions that we are putting in place to combat fraud, all of these other things that we're talking about to combat fraud and to ensure that people are not being abused or mistreated in their homes, all of that goes into the budget that you would like to slash by 10% because somebody didn't turn in a report. And I agree that we need to be getting the reports that we need to do our jobs. That is a different bill. Trying to say that slashing 10% to an entire agency is a punishment or a political punishment to an administration is so far off base that I am embarrassed we're having this conversation.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is about ensuring that we get the reports that are in law. And to this point, we can't ensure that the people who need the care the most get their care unless we ensure the program integrity standards that we have already placed into law. And if we aren't being delivered these reports and we are seeing the welfare benefits across the state expand and balloon to the tune of doubling in the course of a year, or in the case of autism going up, you know, 3,400%, these are incredibly concerning points. And for us, the money is still allowed to flow to the people who are eligible for the benefits under Minnesota Care and under medical assistance, which is what this bill is about. But we need to ensure that we have the program integrity measures to ensure that we have the reports as to how much these programs are being used and that they're being used appropriately. And I just encourage this legislature to work very hard on ensuring that we get the reports from the state Department of Human Services, who, oh, by the way, in this instance, they're already mandated to deliver this report, and they're not. They're already mandated to do that, and they haven't delivered that report.
Representative Curran.
I hear you. The problem is that we haven't gotten a report. Let's have that conversation. A reduction in an entire agency's budget because of an argument over a report is so overreaching. I'm not sure, again, why we're having this conversation, except for that it absolutely does fall in line with what we're seeing at the federal level, where we just punish people who are in need or struggling or don't have enough resources by taking more resources away. That is absolutely the wrong decision, not only for the United States as a whole, but for Minnesota. We are already under deep punishment, deep political punishment, to actual real people who need these funds and who need services. And what we are doing and what this amendment would do is ensure that the punitive actions at the federal level continue into Minnesota, and on this side we will not have it. Thank you.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, Chair and Representative Schultz. You know, we had a saying here that we're punishing an agency and they can't provide services. Well, when you're not good stewards of taxpayers' dollars and you let $9 billion go out the door, you're not providing service. And we are accountable to individuals who need the services more. It's no different than having a child that needs to go into timeout. I know Representative Schultz has a young one. Sometimes you have to make him accountable and so forth. And we as a body needs to do the same thing for the agencies. If the agency had a good track record, great. But they have done extremely poor at providing the services. So they're the ones that have screwed up. They're the ones that have ran an agency and not keep services accountable and has saw this fraud go crazy. I mean, it's bad when you're in the country and you're in the number one fraud producing state in the country. That's bad. This is smart. It says, hey, you know what? We're tired of your lip service. Thank you, Representative Schultz.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. One of the things I have concerns about is we're talking about punishment for reports not coming. And we already have a tool that we could be using, and that's bringing the agency in front of the committee and grilling them in front of the committee. We do that on many other things to get the point across without costing money to the department. I think that's reasonable, and we've had the department in multiple times this year. If that was a problem, why didn't we address it at that point in time? We should have asked them, saying, where is the report? You know, we want them to be held accountable. And one of the things that I do have noticed over time is typically when the agencies get hauled into task before us, that starts getting things to move along. The concerns I have about taking the dollars out is we've already heard repeatedly in this committee how often that the problems we have in the department is because we have not properly funded them for the people they need to hire to do accountability out there to make sure we're getting things out the door. This would just make it worse and compound the problems that we're facing. I heard the allegations that we had a $9 billion. We've not seen anything in this committee showing that specifically that we've had $9 billion. There's fraud out there, but not at that level. I think it's important that we realize that the consequences of putting on a 10% penalty could make other issues worse that we have right now that we're trying to get the department to correct.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Schultz, for bringing this bill. You know, I asked a while back when we were just beginning our conversations on fraud to this group, I said, you know, we're all wanting to know, what did you know and when did you know it? That's the problem. No one's given us the information. We get blanked out reports. We get information that we're supposed to get that we're not getting. There's no interest in us knowing it. There's no interest in getting that information to us. And this is a way that we put on some pressure. The pretty please, give me the report, is not working. We need to hold people accountable in government for giving us what's under statute, and it's not happening. What did they know, and when did they know it? 4 years ago, we should have got this information, and we've been neglected to get it. That's what's wrong here. That's the reason why there's a penalty. Because under the current situation, we have no one interested in giving us that data. And when they do give us, they give us some bogus report that gives us no information. That's why we see a difference in the $9 billion versus what they give us here. We have no accountability to it. No one ever tells us what it all means. They give us a grandiose, over-the-top, a high-level report, and it tells us nothing. We need to do better for taxpayers. Thank you.
Representative Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if there's someone here from DHS who could explain why the reporting requirement's not being met.
Is there anyone here from DHS who could help Representative Gordon with this question? Director Grom, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Christy Grom, and I'm with the Department of Human Services. I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Representative Gordon.
Well, it's kind of the whole conversation we've been having here. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, why in statute it requires you guys to submit this reporting, but it's not being done? I mean, that's, I think, the whole question we've been talking about for the last 5 minutes.
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I appreciate you restating the question so that I'm answering what you want to hear from us. So the periodic data matching is something that the department does on a regular basis. There was a pause during the public health emergency that was required by the federal government in order to maintain federal financial participation at an enhanced level, so bringing more revenue into the state to maintain, and the requirement to get that match was to continuous eligibility. So periodic data matching was paused during a period during the public health emergency. And during that period, the department communicated with the legislature that because it was paused, we were not going to submit the legislative report. And I believe during that time, there were a couple modifications to the report requirement. There was an expiration, I think, initially in 2023 that the legislature asked for. The following year, it was amended by the legislature to expire in 2027. So we are open to providing those reports. We weren't doing them during the pandemic because it was paused by the federal government to maintain that match. We don't have any issue with continuing to do this report if that's what the legislature would like. And I do want to just own up that the last report would have been due the fall of 2025, and that was something that our team, unfortunately, is still working to complete. But they're working on that right now, and we're willing to get that to you as soon as possible.
Representative Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you sure there wasn't a report due in 24 as well, 24 and 25?
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative, my understanding is the reporting period for 2024 would have been submitted in 2025.
Representative Gordon.
And prior to that, I believe we were still in the, I'd have to get you the timeline of the public health emergency and when that ended, but happy to do that, Representative. Pardon me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So regardless, you're behind on the reporting. I mean, it needs to be done. It's in statute, and I think this amendment gives us teeth to enforce and make sure that it gets done in the future.
To this testifier, Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Grum, was there a requirement from the federal government to stop doing periodic marching and to do continuous coverage during the pandemic, including until the end of the unwinding?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Chair Knorr, yes, that is my understanding.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Grum, is there a requirement under the CMS and including in our systems that we continue to do after the end of the pandemic to start doing data matching, because it's a required process by the federal government for us to cross-check, particularly when it's ex parte, using the information that is readily available to the state, whether it's the revenue department, whether it's the other income verifications, because I worked in the system. I know there's a trigger process where the data comes through the system from the federal government, the state agencies, to match with a specific individual. Is that a system that is required both by federal and state law?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair Knorr, that is my understanding that, and the department resumed periodic data matching following the public health emergency, I believe it was April of 2024, if I'm not mistaken. I will also note that the bill that changed Medicaid at the federal level over the past summer, that was passed on July 4th by Congress, also requires six-month redeterminations for the expansion population. And so that will be a new requirement that the department will need to comply with at the federal level, which is a more robust requirement than periodic data matching.
Chair Knorr.
Maybe I'll reserve it for the former Representative Dowd, because we had the same conversation on the floor almost 2 years ago about this specific issue when it was stopped, making sure that we can continue after that. You can go back and watch when we were talking about the unwinding. Exact statements that the federal government required us to stop doing data matching and to continue coverage for individuals until the end of the unwinding. The exact conversation that we're having here today, we had it on the floor and discussed it.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing we've learned in all of this is that our departments directly report to the executive branch, and the ability for the legislature to come in and impact the day-to-day operations of our state departments is very limited because of that direct report to the executive branch. So the influence that we have, the ability to guide and direct our departments, comes by the statutes that we have, right? Because again, it's very reasonable that you can't report to us and you can't report to the governor's office and have that all some way match up. What if we don't agree? Ultimately, you have to report to the executive branch. You know, and if for example, the state of North Dakota used to have very low speeding ticket prices, maybe $10, maybe $15, maybe $20. A lot of people would speed in North Dakota without hesitation. They've begun to raise those a bit now. Minnesota has had speeding tickets of $150 to $200 for a long time, and that was prohibitive enough that folks, it would modify their behavior, right? So behavior modification often comes from that negative feedback that you would get from an undesirable performance and an undesirable feedback. So that's my long way of saying, I think statutorily we need to put some teeth into this that do create the guardrails, that financial penalty that would be there for not reporting, because that's our role as legislature. We have that influence on the department statutorily, not in day-to-day operation. And I would be glad to hear a response. Just do the reporting, of course, and you don't lose the 10%, right? That's the caveat to this. Just do the reporting. It did its job by motivating you to continue timely reporting, and therefore it's all good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gander. Who would you like that response from? From whom would you like that response?
Whomever is able to respond. Chair. Thank you, Mr.
Director
Chair.
Director Grum.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Gander, I hear you. I will say it has long been recognized by this legislature that the reporting requirements on the Department of Human Services are excessive. We want to do those reports. Our team is working around the clock. They are extremely hard workers, as Chair Knorr has mentioned. It does not feel good to not make our deadlines to the department. You don't have to believe me, but I just want to put that on the record that we strive to do the best we can to respond to what the legislature is asking of us and what the community at large expects of us. In 2020 or 2021, then chair of Senate Health and Human Services, Senator Benson, Chair Benson, worked with the department to right-size the legislative reports that are required of the department because we have long been unable to meet the requirements that the legislature has put in statute. So that's where there were requirements. There were subdivisions. There was a subdivision in the statute where the report was expiring. And there are, you can read in 256, I think it's 01, the requirements around when legislative reports expire. And so that was an effort by legislators back then to try to right-size the workload for the agency in a way that we could meet the requirements and get the legislature the information that they had requested. I think to the amendment of, you know, imposing a requirement of a 10% reduction, I think then the legislature maybe would consider what other reports currently exist in statute would you like us to not do? Or, as Chair Knorr has stated, you know, exploring the administrative realities of the department, we've got between 2 and 3% operating budget, including all staff and all systems. I think you would be hard-pressed to find an organization in the private sector that can actually maintain on that level of operating. So, long answer, but I'm happy to work with you all. Again, we want to get you this report, and we are actively working on it right now.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If there would be a working group formed to look at all of the reporting that you all have to do and eliminate anything that's not really the product of that report, is no longer even necessary, I guarantee there are some elements of that reporting that's happening that nobody's really using it for much of anything anymore. Maybe it was relevant once. So if there's ever a working group like that to maybe eliminate some of that, I would be happy to serve on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That is so noted, Representative Gander. Before I go to a final word on this amendment from the bill author, is there anyone else who would like recognition on the A2 amendment? Seeing none, final word, Chair Knorr.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to request a roll call on the amendment that is a 10% reduction of the agency for not giving us a report.
All right, roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call. Final word for the A2 amendment, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad that we'll have the chance to put this on the record for folks to tell us whether what is in statute should be delivered to this legislature. We are a co-equal branch of government, and it's about time that we take a stand to ensure that we're stopping the fraud in Minnesota and that we do this so that we demand more from our executive branch. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, I will renew my A2 amendment and we'll take the roll.
Chair Schumacher.
Aye.
Chair Knorr.
No.
Vice Chair Gilman.
Yes.
Vice Chair Keeler.
No.
Representative Backer.
Yes.
Representative Curran.
No.
Representative Fisher.
Fisher, no.
Representative Franson.
Franson, yes.
Representative Frederick.
No.
Representative Gander.
Yes.
Representative Gordon.
Yes.
Representative Hicks. Representative Jacob.
Yes.
Representative Knutson.
Yes.
Representative Momani Hiltzi.
Momani Hiltzi, no.
Representative Murphy.
Yes.
Representative Norris.
No.
Representative Vernig.
No.
Right, there being 9 votes for the affirmative and 8 votes for the negative with 1 abstention, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. To the underlying bill and for your presentation. Representative Schultz, welcome to the committee and please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill specifically about the reporting requirements for periodic data matching. And while the legislature has received two of these reports, over the last 10 years when this was originally put into law, we have only received two reports. And yet this sunsets at the end of this year on January 1st of 2027. And so with this bill, we would be removing the sunset and ensuring that this report is something that we do in the future to stop the waste, fraud, and abuse of our tax dollars within Minnesota Care and within medical assistance. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And you have a testifier, former Speaker Kurt Dowd. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kurt Dowd, former state representative and former Speaker of the House, and Representative Schultz was my legislative assistant while I was Speaker, so it's nice to be here with him. Thank you, committee members, for the work that you're doing, and appreciate your efforts in letting me testify this morning. The periodic data matching program was something that was put into law in 2015 when I was Speaker. It was something that I negotiated with the administration. I can assure you they fought me tooth and nail on this to the point where it took us 4 years to actually get the program implemented. It went into law in 2015. It was not implemented until 3.5 years, late 2018. The program was incredibly successful. The program was designed to eliminate people from two public programs that do not qualify for those programs. During its 18 months that it was in existence, it eliminated around 37,500 people from those two public programs. People accessing public programs who do not qualify is fraud. Let me be clear about that. The dollars that you all have, you know, in very limited quantity to help people are designed to go to help people. And when we spend them on people who do not qualify for that help, they are defrauding the state and taking dollars away from people that should be getting them. The program was suspended in, as I said, it was in effect for 18 months. It was suspended in March of 2020. There are two reports that were submitted. The law also requires a report to the legislature every September. There were two reports that were submitted to the legislature, one in September of 2019, one in September of 2020. During COVID, the program was suspended by executive order by the governor, and the program was set to be reinstated after COVID, the public health emergency had completed, That time period, I think, by all accounts, is early in 2024, I believe March of 2024. There is a report that was due to the legislature in in September of 2024, and one that was due to the legislature in 2025 in September. Those two reports have not been submitted to the legislature, are not available publicly, were not created by the department, and I can only assume. I do know a member of the legislature who in late 2024 asked the department if this program had been reinstated. The department said no, it had not yet been reinstated. I would be willing to bet every penny that I have that this program is not being conducted currently. And if it was, and if you as a committee member had read these reports, you would know that they are very simple. One could be completed in probably a couple of days if you had the underlying data. But the fact is that the 2024 report and the 2025 report have not been completed, and I can only assume, and as you should as committee members assume, if you're not receiving the report, you should assume that the program is not being conducted. That's a very reasonable assumption on your part. So it's not just about receiving the report, it's actually about conducting this program. I have heard folks state that the feds require us to do this anyways. This in-state law is much more detailed. It requires a periodic data matching every month. The feds do not require that. And if folks tell you that they are conducting this program based on federal guidelines, they are defying Minnesota state law. And we already know they're defying Minnesota state law because they haven't submitted the two required reports that are already overdue. If they have done the program and they have the data, you should have these reports on your desk tomorrow because they'd be that easy to complete. So Folks, this isn't just about the reports. It is about the underlying program, and it is about ensuring that Minnesota tax dollars and federal tax dollars are going to people that actually need that help. And it's your job and your responsibility to make sure that happens, and this is one very simple way that you can do it. And I appreciate Representative Curran saying that she supports you all receiving these reports, and I look forward to her supporting this bill.
Thank you. Former Speaker Dowd, is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 4101? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Member questions or comments? Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to correct the record that the periodic matching, this law that we're looking right now, is about the reporting, not the data matching. In fact, we should be creating the requirement of data matching, which we're required to. Even by HR 1, it increased the number of data matching that is required of. And if I recall, and looking through the system, Session Law 2023, Chapter 22, paused the periodic matching, which means that we were not going to get this report. It's in the law that we passed in 2023 because there was no requirement for us to get the PDMs to be done. But nevertheless, this section of the law that we're looking into does not authorize the periodic matching. It only authorizes reporting of that data. So I just wanted to be more, we need to be more straightforward. If it's about reporting, yes, let's talk about reporting. But it's not authorizing any PDM, as stated in the conversation right now. Does, Mr. Chair, my question is, does this legislation that we're looking into, 256B.0561, require the agency to do periodic data matching, or is it just about the reporting?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's right in subdivision 2 of the underlying statute. So subdivision 2, periodic data matching. The commissioner shall conduct periodic data matching to identify recipients who, based upon available electronic data, may not meet eligibility criteria for the public health care program in which the recipient is enrolled. It goes on. But that says it plainly right there in subdivision 2 of 256B.0561.
Former Speaker Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. To answer your question very directly, the bill in front of you is only about the report. The requirement for periodic data matching exists in current law. It is there, and it will remain there, short of someone removing it through a bill. But it absolutely is a requirement in current law, and there's no evidence that the department's actually doing it.
Chair Knorr.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make sure that I get that clarity from the agency. Are they not doing any periodic data matching? That's the exact question we should be asking. I don't know if someone from the agency can come to the testifier table, because it's going to be really, really outrageous that the requirement under CMS and the requirement under the state that we should continue to have data matching. If it's not being done, then we have got a big problem. Director Grom?
Welcome back, Ms. Grom. Director Grom, if you could please help Chair Knorr with this question.
Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, the department has resumed periodic data matching. We are doing that. There was a bulletin issued to the public, but when we would resume that data matching following the public health emergency unwind, and that was July of 2024. We are indeed doing periodic data matching as required by law.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think that is what needs to be clarified. The state is doing periodic data matching. If we're not doing that, we're in violation of CMS rules. And if we're in violation of CMS rules, then we don't get any funding associated with Medicaid, which pays for most of the services. So we need to be more accurate with the statement. This is about reporting, which is subdivision 4, not about the PDM, which is a different discussion. We're going to be extending the PDMs because of the HR 1 requirement that has already put a lot of burdensome to the state and the counties to keep on doing 6 months review and many things for the expansion population. That's a different bill for a different discussion, and we will be able to get through so that we are aligned with the federal requirement under HR 1. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. Is there anyone else who has any questions or comments? Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. So my question is for Director Grom. If you resumed July of 2024. Where are those two reports? That's the question.
Director Grohm.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, my understanding, we would need a full year to look back, and so it would be, the report would have been due, there's one report that would have been due in the fall of 2025 to get you the full picture of the previous year. That report is currently being finished with our healthcare administration staff as we speak.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much. And then is there a discussion, have you talked about costs associated with extending the sunset? Again, if there's not, I just want to know what is the funding piece of it. Again, we see in the governor's executive order that it expires January 1st of 2027. So is there a cost associated with that? Continuing.
Director Grohm.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, I don't have an answer to that question, and Ms. Bailey, our budget director, is in the other body this morning, but we can certainly follow up with you and get you more information.
Too bad for Director Bailey. Former Speaker Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, for the question. The original bill that this passed in that authorized periodic data matching in 2015 was the Health and Human Services Finance Bill during the 2015 session. That bill had a fiscal note, and that fiscal note outlined a cost of about $1.2 million to implement the program and $400,000 to $500,000 for the ongoing operation of the program. That included the money needed to conduct the report, and that money was captured by the savings from the reduction in folks who were fraudulently collecting these programs who should not have been. So that's the financial background of this program.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that clarity on that. Again, I just want to go back to, we already have in statute things that will help us be in compliance with the federal government. And again, because waste, fraud, and abuse is something that touches our committees the most, and we care for the most vulnerable in our state. We want to ensure that these reports are coming through so we can understand where we can continue to create guardrails and do, do more collaboration to ensure that this money is going to be here for those that we care about the most. So, thanks.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this will be for our agency. So we're hearing that periodic data matching has the ability to find some cost savings by taking out maybe folks that wouldn't qualify, or maybe some redundant folks who are maybe in there twice. So we're finding some savings in the early going, probably some ongoing savings. Now, are we still experiencing those savings when your department is doing the periodic data matching and finding those duplicate enrollees, or maybe ones who wouldn't qualify? Even without you doing the annual reporting, are we still experiencing the savings to the overall agency? Thank you.
Director Grohm.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Gander, I would assume so. I guess I haven't seen the most recent report and what the data looks like, so I would want to look at that to give you a more definitive response. But of course, while periodic data matching was paused over the public health emergency, we would not be experiencing any kind of impact there.
Mr. Dow.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker and Representative. During the operation of the program, during the 18 months that it was in effect, that we do have reports for, the first report indicated, and I'm saying this from memory, but it's approximately 20,500 people, something like that, were permanently removed from these two public programs. The second report was only in effect for, or the period that it covered was only in effect for 6 months, and it removed about 17,000 people from public programs during that time. So a reasonable assumption, and I assume there's been growth, and with the explosion in fraud, even with no growth, you can expect 20 to 30,000 people based on that previous data. With an explosion of fraud in our other programs, I think you could assume it could be much, much higher than that. But with the most conservative estimates, the program should be removing 20 to 30,000 individuals who don't qualify on an annual basis.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so I'm clear, kind of the inner workings of the agency. So the data are gleaned from our study. We've done our periodic data matching, and the data are gleaned from the study. So what's done with the data? Where do those data go next to accomplish the savings that we're looking for to take out the fraudulent ones? Who takes that data and who acts on it, and what action do they take?
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gander, when an individual is identified through periodic data matching as not meeting the eligibility requirements, they are removed from the program. So that would effectively, I assume, impact, you know, spending and medical assistance and Minnesota Care.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And your staff are empowered to do that just ongoing, no special action needed. It's automatically part of their charge.
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gander, yes. If someone isn't eligible for the program, they cannot remain on the program.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for the panel that we have up there right now? Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. This would be for one of our testifiers, probably the department is. It's important we have the reports. I see that or hear that your folks are working on it. One of the questions I have about the report is there anything that's done to help track the people who are non-responsive? Did they re-enroll at one point, et cetera? And the reason I ask is so often in the homeless youth, in the homeless community, they're very mobile. And with the requirements for getting, you know, for documentation, if they're not, if they don't have a permanent address or if they were unstably housed and moved, they fall off and then have to be re-enrolled. I don't see it in the report. Is that something that you folks have? Is it something that you can include in the future?
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, that's a great question. My understanding is it's not just when someone is identified as ineligible income-wise or, you know, asset-wise that they get removed from the program as a result of periodic data matching. It is also if they don't respond. So there indeed could be individuals, and particularly in transient populations like youth experiencing homelessness, for example, that may not respond. They don't get the notice. It's not that they're not actually eligible from an income perspective, but they don't respond, so then they would fall off of the program. And I think maybe what you're leading to with your question is there is potentially churn with certain populations that are more transient and may be removed from our Minnesota healthcare programs as a result of PDM when it's just that they miss the paperwork to respond to the request.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. So while it appears that we do have churn out there right now, there's nothing that is tracking these folks so that we have an idea of what percentage is churning.
Director Grom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, apologies for not being more direct to your last question. I will check with our team to see if we have the data on the individuals who are removed from Minnesota healthcare programs as a result of either income eligibility or versus just didn't respond to the request. And I will follow up with you in the committee on that.
Senator Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Thank you, Director Grom. I would appreciate knowing more on that because it happens not only the people are unstably housed, but I've had people that have reached out to me over the past year where something happened, they submitted it, didn't get through. Because we're still using faxes. We've got old technology when they're spending forms. And so often if people are dealing with different disabilities, physical, mental health, et cetera, they think they've got it in, they've submitted in, and it's gotten lost in the process. And as a result, they lose coverage. And so just trying to, eventually they do get enrolled, but for that period of time, they could be uncovered. And so I'm just trying to figure out what can be done differently so that we don't have people who should have continued in coverage getting lost in the process. So besides the fact figures you're looking at, it'd be nice to know more information on the other side.
That line of discussion, Mr. Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. And I appreciate your concerns, and I share those with you. Certainly don't want to throw people off of a program that that need those services. The reality is, and I appreciate the department's mentioning that that folks who don't respond are also thrown off, but I would note that the program does not just target everyone. It looks at different databases to find out if we received information that would contradict whether they are eligible. It looks at things like the Social Security databases, which actually know what your income is, right? So it's only targeting people that we basically have received information that they do not qualify. So it's not just a random thing where people that have no income are targeted for this.
Is there anyone else who's seeking recognition for questions or comments on this bill before we go to final word? Chair Noor.
Quick comment. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to note that we received the payment error rate measurements, which is the PAM for the state of Minnesota. You know, the data that we have from the federal government, CMS, doing the review on Medicaid, because they do that review, the state of Minnesota was 2.1%. The national average is 6.1%. Just wanted to put that on the record so that people understand that there are multiple reviews, not only state reviews, but also we have got federal review, and you can read that data for yourself.
Final word, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for this robust discussion about ensuring that we have these reporting requirements to ensure that the executive branch is doing as they must do according to law. That's what this is about. And so we need to remove this sunset. And I just want to say that there is no amount of error or fraud that is truly acceptable in the eyes of Minnesotans, especially when the Department of Human Services has been so wholly unaccountable to the people, which has resulted in just this grotesque level of fraud in Minnesota. And I'll just say, they began this reporting again in July of 2024. Nothing in law precluded them from delivering a report for those 3 months in September of 2024. This legislature could have had two separate reports to look back on this data to see the waste, fraud, and abuse, and to ensure that we're protecting the public's money. And so as we look forward, we need to remove this sunset so that the legislature has this information to appropriately hold the Walz administration and future administrations accountable. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, I will renew my motion that House File 4101 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Schultz and former Speaker Dowd. Next, and probably finally today, House File 4144, Representative Nadeau. And as he makes his way forward, I will move that House File 4144 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. Representative Nadeau, whenever you're ready, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. There is an amendment that I'd like someone to move for this bill, if they could.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau. I will move the A2-1 amendment. Representative Nadeau, to the amendment.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, this amendment is kind of the final touches. I'm going to go into the work that we did to get to this point. But this amendment basically makes some final changes that our stakeholder group wanted to make in the bill. I'm happy to go over each one of them, but it's pretty common sense. We extended the effective date to give the agency a little bit more time. We changed notification from 30 days prior to municipal notification to 10 days post. We removed health rules from something that a local unit of government could actually, in partnership with the agency, do. And then regarding MARC notification, we changed some language regarding lead investigative agency notifying the reporter and applicable case manager or case manager supervisor. That's the amendment.
Are there any technical questions to the amendment, the author's amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the A2-1 amendment, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. The A2-1 is adopted. Representative Nadeau, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill, last session we heard a bit of feedback. And this bill is all about concentrations of group homes in northwest Hennepin County. We heard a lot of feedback from providers. We heard a lot of feedback from local government. And so what we did was we went to work. And our goal was to find and ensure structurally consistent facilities that operate safely. We wanted to make sure residents of the group homes and the communities were protected. We wanted to ensure that local emergency services weren't overwhelmed. We wanted to make sure that we didn't concentrate high-needs residents in one area, and we wanted to overall make sure that local gov and the state have the tools to work together to ensure that our responses to people suffering from mental health crisis are met. I want to thank the stakeholders. We had individual providers, we had provider associations, we had the Department of Human Services, Department of Health, individual cities, the League of Minnesota Cities, Ombudsman for Long-Term Care, Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, Hennepin County, and others. We understood, and we still do, and we agree that returning rental licensure authority to cities was, you know, not somewhere we wanted to go. And this bill doesn't do that. And what we do is we focus on solutions that improve oversight, communication, coordination, while keeping license authority within the state. This bill focuses on four areas. We started at 9. With all of the input, we got to 4. First, it improves communications between reporters of abuse and the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center to improve responsiveness and better wrap services around people when concerns about resident safety are reported. Second, it extends facility distancing requirements statewide. Currently, Minneapolis, Duluth, Rochester and St. Paul have some distancing requirements in place today for certain DHS licensed facilities. This bill lowers those restrictions currently in place from 1,320 feet to 650 feet across the state, and it applies those distancing, those proximity requirements to both DHS and MDH licensed facilities. Importantly, this distancing requirement is not retroactive. It's not going to help, and we're going to hear from the city of Brooklyn Park. It's not going to help the city of Brooklyn Park. It applies to new licenses moving forward. And in your packet, you will see some graphics that show some of the concentrations that are occurring in Northwest Hennepin County. This is an inclusive and neutral policy that will prevent clustering, segregating, and excluding people from areas. Third, the bill requires notification to local jurisdictions when a new license is issued. And the goal here was to allow cities to build relationships, be proactive, work with providers early to ensure that all of their needs are being met. Fourth, it allows for a partnership. It's a permissive language that allows for a partnership between agencies and cities for building inspections through delegation authorities. Once again, a city that doesn't have congregate care settings probably wouldn't want to do this. There are cities that have concentrations that might want to do that, and the agencies get to decide whether or not they do that. This proposal is about integrating people with disabilities and aging adults in community and being proactive about ensuring that we don't inadvertently create institutionalized cul-de-sacs and neighborhoods. It's about working to ensure that people living in community that struggle with mental health crisis are receiving the best response in a timely manner. And now I want to turn it over to my testifiers. And my co-author first.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Co-chairs Noor and Schumacher, members of the committee and the public, before I begin, I want to acknowledge Representative Nadeau for the work done during the interim, bringing stakeholders together and creating space for honest and at times difficult conversations. I was in some of those rooms, I listened, I engaged, and I appreciate the intent behind this effort. I also want to recognize the experts here in the room who will speak to the many dimensions of this bill, helping to provide context and perspective both in support and opposition. But for me today, I want to ground us in one word, choice. Before I speak as a legislator, I want to speak as Hulda. At 16 years old, I became a CNA. For 15 years, I worked in nursing homes, group homes, assisted living, caring for individuals with disabilities, individuals living with Alzheimer's, our older adults, you name it. And through that experience, I learned something that no policy paper can teach you. Quality of life is deeply tied to two things, love of family and safe place to call home. Not just home, a home you have a say in. So let me be clear from the beginning that this bill is not about targeting individuals with disabilities or a certain community. As a woman of color, as an immigrant, and someone who understands what it feels like to be misunderstood, labeled, and sometimes targeted, I will never support anything that marginalizes any community. That is not who I am, and that's not why I serve. What this bill is about is whether we are being honest about systems we have built because we have to ask ourselves, are individuals truly choosing where they live, or are we, or are decisions being made for them? As I proudly represent Brooklyn Park, the most diverse city in the whole entire state of Minnesota, we welcome everyone. That is not just something we say, it's something we live. And yet Brooklyn Park has close to 500 congregate care homes. So I have to ask this body a very direct question. How many congregate homes are in Wayzata, Edina, Minnetonka, and some of our wealthier neighborhoods? I can bet it's not close to 500. But because if choice is truly equal, the distribution should be too. And I am not speaking from theory. Since 2021, I have been door knocking across the city of Brooklyn Park. I have done many ride-alongs. I have sat with residents. I have spoken with city staff. I have walked into some of the homes myself, and what I saw was not always acceptable. There are homes operating in deplorable conditions. There are situations where city staff are stepping in to fill in caregiving gaps, doing work that should have been done by trained staffers. Our city continues to respond with compassion and grace, but let's be honest, this is not sustainable. And you will hear that from the testifiers today. And more importantly, it's not fair to the individual receiving care. So again, this is not about individuals. This is about a system. Now, let's talk about consistency. Minneapolis has a 1,300 feet distance requirement. Brooklyn Park is asking for 650, less restrictive, and yet we are being labeled discriminatory. How is this one city can have stronger spacing requirements when other cities asks for balance, we are accused of exclusion? This is not consistency. This is not equity. And if we are serious about choice, we must also confront this. Right now, in my understanding, many individuals living in congregate settings, especially in Brooklyn Park and some other cities, do not have a choice to move out, even if they wanted to. So I ask you this, how is that choice? Members, we have to start talking around the issue and name it clearly. This is not one issue, it is a system that needs to be recalibrated. We have a distribution issue where too many settings are concentrated in a few cities instead of being shared across communities statewide providing choice. We have a support problem where cities like Brooklyn Park are carrying disproportionate burden without the resources to sustain it. We have accountability problem where some providers, not all, are not meeting the standards of care, putting individuals at risk. And we have a choice problem because placements is too many often driven by systems convenient rather than the individual preference. And I believe our common ground is stronger than our disagreements. If we choose to center it, we all want to protect individuals with disabilities, not just a policy, but in practice. We all want to ensure dignity, which includes the ability to choose where and how someone lives. We all want safe, high-quality care for every individual in every community. We should all want support cities so that they are not set up to fail under an imbalanced system. And we must be willing to hold providers accountable because accountability is part of protection. Because let's be clear, protecting dignity also means telling the truth about what is not working. And when we have the courage to do that, not to blame, not to fix, but to fix, that is where the real solution begins. In closing, let me be clear. I want to see this bill move forward, but I want it done the right way. Laying this bill over gives us yet another opportunity to get it right. Because the individuals we are talking about, their dignity, their safety, their right to choose must be at the heart of the bill that this body eventually votes on. This moment, this pass is not a setback. It's an opportunity for all of us, for all key stakeholders, an opportunity for all of us to come back to the table, confront the hard truths, build system that is fair, balanced, and truly centered on choice. I'm committed to doing the work alongside each stakeholder willing to engage in good faith, because at the end of the day, this is not about us. It's about getting it right for the people who are dependent on us to do so. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Representative. We have 15 minutes here, and we will start with the public testimony, first with Champa Mayor. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Champlin is a city of nearly 25,000 residents and currently has 54 congregate care facilities in our community, some of which are multi-level, multi-unit facilities. Our local public safety personnel, police, fire, and EMS are the boots on the ground who see firsthand when vulnerable adults need help. In Champlin's experience, when our public safety officials communicate concerns to the state agencies about vulnerable adults or life and safety issues in these facilities, there is often little or no response. That leaves our staff without clear guidance on how to help the residents, the providers, and their surrounding neighbors. Over the last 5 years, Champlin's calls for service to congregate care facilities has increased by 121.4%, from 397 calls in 2020 to 879 calls in 2025. This trend tells us something is not working. It has also created disproportionate strain on our public safety resources, particularly for a police department with only 30 sworn officers. Our embedded social worker's caseload is already full, and she could easily spend all of her time solely supporting the residents of cognitive care facilities. Because she must serve our entire community, that leaves gaps in services for other residents, including vulnerable adults, children, and families. At one time, Hennepin County provided a social worker specifically assigned to cognitive care facilities, but that resource is no longer available. We are also seeing facilities concentrated in a small number of communities, Champlin, Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, and nearby areas. Cities of the first class in Minnesota already have the spacing requirements of 1,320 feet between cognitive care facilities. We are simply asking for half of that, 650 feet, for all communities in Minnesota to help prevent overconcentration. In Champlin, we have a specific neighborhood of Pennsylvania Avenue where a lack of state oversight and regulation has allowed one block to effectively become an institution. Several cognitive care facilities now surround and intermingle with single-family homes. The constant emergency calls at this level are not good for the residents living in these facilities or for the surrounding neighborhood. In fact, one of our highly regarded city council members, Nate Truesdale, resigned after 9 years of service and moved out of Champlin because his home had become located within a dense concentration of cognitive care facilities that had fundamentally changed the character of what was once a traditional single-family neighborhood. We are asking for reasonable tools to ensure better balance, oversight, and protection for vulnerable adults, our neighborhoods, and our police safety resources.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, for your comments this morning.
Thank you.
Next, we have Councilmember Nicole Klonowski.
Yes, thank you, Chair, committee members. My name is Nicole Klonowski, and I'm a Brooklyn Park City Council member. I've spent more than 20 years working directly with people with disabilities and mental health concerns, primarily in nonprofit vocational programs helping adults live and work in their communities. I helped establish one of the first fully community-integrated programs in West St. Paul supporting adults on the autism spectrum. Throughout my career, the focus has always been person-centered care with dignity, independence, and true community integration. This issue is also deeply personal for me and my family. I have an adult daughter with severe disabilities that lives with me and a granddaughter on the autism spectrum in my home as well. My family also carries generational trauma tied to institutionalization. My great-grandmother, Rosella, was institutionalized from a childhood at the Owatonna State School, and she spent her entire life in state institutions. While she was institutionalized as a young teenager, she was sexually assaulted. My grandfather was the result of that. He spent his life in a state-run orphanage. Rosella lived her entire life as a ward of the state, and due to that status, when she died, she was buried in an unmarked grave on the border of Brooklyn Park and Brooklyn Center. For decades, our country worked to move people out of institutions and into the community. That's why what I'm seeing now in Brooklyn Park and our surrounding communities is concerning for me. I worked in mission-driven places centered on people, and today we are allowing that model to be replaced by a for-profit business model where corporations and LLCs are making decisions based on profit. And the numbers show how dramatic the shift has been. In Brooklyn Park, less than 3% of our congregate care homes are nonprofit. That means 97% are corporations and LLCs. Families are losing real choice about where their loved ones live. Congregate care homes are becoming extremely concentrated in a small number of communities, particularly in the North Metro. Brooklyn Park now has more small assisted living facilities in our one city than every other county in the state besides Hennepin County. That level of concentration is not community integration, and it is not person-centered care. These profit-driven staffing models are also affecting the quality of care these vulnerable human beings are receiving. We are seeing situations where staff do not even know the names of the residents they're responsible for or understand their complex medical conditions. And because the staffing is insufficient, oftentimes our police, our firefighters, and EMS are called to respond to situations that trained caregivers should be handling. Meanwhile, the residents living in these homes are receiving far less care than they deserve. And in some cases, the consequences are tragic. In Brooklyn Park recently, our police found a vulnerable adult drowned in a retention pond. The staff did not even know that person was missing. This is profit-driven placement. We are seeing this profit-driven model determine where these homes are located. We are seeing LLCs and corporate providers purchasing large numbers of single-family homes in highly concentrated areas where the housing is more affordable. This concentration is not the result of person-centered choice. It is the result of a distinct business model. Excuse me.
And Councilmember, if you could please wrap it up.
What I'm seeing in my community is the opposite of everything I worked towards during my career in human services. For decades, advocates have fought for people to move out of institutions and into communities. But what we are seeing today is drifting back towards that system. We have simply rearranged what institutionalization looks like. And instead of one institutional building, we are creating institutionalized neighborhoods. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Brooklyn Park Mayor Holly Swinston.
Hi. So thank you. Chair and committee for having me. My name is Hollis Winston, Mayor of the wonderful city of Brooklyn Park. We're about the sixth largest in the state. I initially came here thinking I was going to speak about the disproportionate impact of congregate care facilities within the city of Brooklyn Park. I think folks have done some of that before me. But I also want to tell just a brief story. So regarding my own background, I am the first child that was born out of de jure segregation or de facto redlining. So my family originally from South, then moved to Chicago. And when you look at the redlining we had, we could only live in the west side of Chicago or the south side of Chicago. If you did better and you were black, you moved from the west side to the south side. I was the first that was able to be born in one of the northwest suburbs. And so when we look at what's happening within the city of Brooklyn Park, I know that someone said that our approach is akin to redlining. Redlining is when people draw a line around a particular area and they say, you have to stay within this particular area. That is what my family experienced for generation upon generation. What we are seeing in Brooklyn Park is de facto segregation of congregate care facilities. We're also seeing de facto segregation along some other lines within Brooklyn Park as well. But we're here to focus on congregate care facilities. I think when we talk about the impacts of segregation or redlining, there's a number of historical things that have come out of that, and I think we've settled that we are against that as a country, both within the court system and otherwise. But some of the things that have come out of this with regards to Brooklyn Park are this. It's a regressive tax. So we're all in terms of working with congregate care facilities within the city of Brooklyn Park. We have an alternative response team, and we have community intervention, which we have used to de-escalate situations because we are not interested in criminalizing people within congregate care facilities. We spend about $1 million on that. 10% of our calls, I believe congregate care facilities are less than 2% of housing within Brooklyn Park. 10% of our calls go to in public safety go to that, with a tab of about $5 million. So it is a regressive tax on some of the most vulnerable and poorest communities within the state. There's less options for those who want to have congregate care facilities where they actually live because they are concentrated in one particular area. And then, of course, there's the lack of oversight and capacity within our city. So when we talk about MARC reports, we, between a 10-month period last year, received 417 MARC reports that were saying that there's criminal activity in some of these facilities within the city of Brooklyn Park. We have to investigate that. There is another 112 that occurred at the state level that the state is going to be looking into. So perhaps even more important than all of that, though, is that the policy that is being put in place, which is de facto, is basically creating a institutionalization that is state-sponsored segregation or regional redlining, and that runs contrary to settled precedent that we have fought through within the United States of America. And I believe that the state of Minnesota has said that they are against that level of segregation. So we're asking, with this legislation, we are asking the state to avoid the repercussions that come from segregation. We've heard about them historically. We do not want to reenact that within the city of Brooklyn Park or Brooklyn Center. We don't want to redline those particular areas. And then we don't want to extend slightly that redlining to the northwest suburbs, because we have decided by our policies that that is where this should be concentrated when we're talking about actual people. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Next we have Chiquillo Richmond. After that, we have Josh Berg and Sarah Grafstrom. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Yes, good morning, Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, members of the committee. My name is Shakaya Richmond. I'm a member of Residential Providers Association of Minnesota, otherwise known as RPAMN. RPAMN is a nonprofit association, the nonprofit trade association that represents small residential customized living and waiver service providers in Minnesota. I am testifying today to provide feedback and share some concerns with House File 4144. While RPAMN does have concerns with the language as it currently exists, I want to start by thanking Representative Nadeau for the time he invested working with RPAMN's leadership and legislative team over the interim alongside numerous stakeholders in this conversation. He sought out RPAMN's engagement throughout the process, and we look forward to continuing those discussions over the coming weeks. RPAMN believes strongly in the rights of individuals with disabilities seeking a provider-controlled setting to reside in settings and communities of their choice. RPAMN also knows that the cost of housing is a major barrier for the individuals with disabilities, particularly those seeking to live in the 7-county metro area, particularly as most small assisted living providers have been unable to contract with counties to be vendors of housing support. Therefore, while RPAMN understands and empathizes with communities, particularly those in the northwest suburbs, which have become home to a disproportionate number of small assisted living facilities and group homes, we believe that any legislative proposals which should focus on the root cause behind setting concentration and look to expand opportunities rather than simply close doors for folks seeking to live in settings of their choosing. As such, we have concerns with the language in sections 1 and 6 that would limit the ability of providers to locate in homes that might be available to meet the state's growing need for long-term care. With respect to other proposals, which include in the bill, RPAMN believes that the author's amendment may have addressed most of the issues we raised in our letter. We will review and continue to engage Representative Nadeau. We know legislation is a work in progress and conversations are ongoing. We want to sincerely thank Representative Nadeau for his proactive engagement with RPAMN since the early weeks of sessions, and we look forward to continuing the work with him as session progresses. Thank you for your time to testify today.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Berg. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Josh Berg, and I'm here today wearing two hats, as a disability services nonprofit provider and as a city council member of Elko Newmarket. Those roles give me perspective I wish more people could see. I see the frontline reality of supporting people with disabilities, and I see how local land use decisions can welcome people into a community or quietly push them out. Minnesota is facing a historic housing shortage, and for people with disabilities who rely on small community-based residential homes, that shortage is even more acute. In moments like this, our principle should be simple: expand access, reduce barriers, and protect civil rights. Yet too often, policies at both the state and local level do the opposite. They create new gatekeepers, spacing limits, proximity restrictions, and tools that quietly make it harder, not easier, for people with disabilities to live in our neighborhoods. We need to start with basic discipline, agree whether there's a problem at all, and then be honest about what the problem actually is. If, to some, the problem is too many people with too high needs, that's not a policy issue. That's prejudice masquerading as planning. I cannot help with that, and this legislature must never codify it. If the problem is provider quality, fix it. Tighten oversight and support improvement. If the problem is city capacity, fix it. Resource local governments to do their job to serve their residents fully and completely. If the problem is a shortage of affordable housing outside the Northwest Metro, fix it. Build, preserve, and fund where people actually live. HF 4144 does none of that. It doesn't solve root causes. It relabels our constituents as the problem. And I reject that as a provider, as a local elected official, and as a Minnesotan. You should too. So let me be equally blunt about our values. People with disabilities have the right to live in our neighborhoods, not somewhere else, here, among us, as neighbors. That is not a courtesy. That is a civil rights guarantee. Policies that restrict where disability homes can operate, spacing rules, proximity bans, special permits, are just modern forms of exclusionary zoning. They isolate people, limit options, and undermine Minnesota's Olmsted commitments to integration. And the harm is real. When disability housing is blocked or pushed out, people lose stability, connection, choice, and belonging. Some end up institutionalized, some unhoused, some forced far from family. All of it is preventable.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Sure, you can submit anything else you may have in writing for that. I apologize, we are very tight on time. We'll hear from Ms. Grafstrom, then from Representative Kern, and then we will lay this over. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Grafstrom. Would you please introduce yourself for this bill and state your testimony?
Thank you, Chair Schumacher, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Grafstrom. I am here representing ARM. I will cut down my testimony and just say that as a 245D licensed provider, we are looking specifically at sections 4, 5, 6, and 7 of the bill. So to section 4, requiring the notification from the commissioner when a new municipality or when a new home is moving in, I know there was an amendment done to the 144G section of the bill. We would appreciate the same amendment added to the notification section for the 245D homes. Again, the 30-day prior to a license being issued timeline would potentially delay a new home being approved. I also would just mention for that piece, we work directly with the lead agency when it comes to licensing homes, and so we would appreciate looking at how the lead agency could take play a role in that notification process. To section 5, around delegating authority to a county agency or local unit of government to inspect a residential program. In 245D homes, this already happens. This authority is delegated to the county agency, and providers pay a $2,100 annual fee per site fee to the lead agency for those inspections. So again, we'd want to look closely at, duplicating inspections and making sure that things are streamlined. And then before I go over to section 6, I'll just say for section 7, around MARC reporting, we would have some concerns with what information is being shared about a vulnerable adult with the reporter. I understand that the intention behind this is making sure that law enforcement that are making MARC reports are getting that follow-up information, but when we are sharing information about why a report is not being investigated, our concern is that information could contain information about a vulnerable adult, and so wanting to make sure that that is not being shared or distributed to anyone that might submit a MARC report. So wanting to look closely at that section as well. Now to section 6 of the bill. This bill imposes proximity limitations on all new licensed homes, as we've talked about, and this is a section of the bill that ARM opposes. I know from working directly with many of you in this committee that you take immense pride and have deep understanding of the responsibility of the legislature when putting in place rules and regulations that support every Minnesotan. Enacting proximity language as proposed in this bill creates barriers to where people with disabilities can live, and further paints the picture of people with disabilities who access services provided in the community residential setting as being different than everyone else. This proposed policy is in direct conflict with the Fair Housing Act of 1988, which makes it unlawful to utilize land use policies or actions that treat groups of persons with disabilities less favorably than groups of non-disabled persons. I would also like to highlight a couple protections that we have in place for 245D homes. Since 2009, 245D licensed CRS have been subject to a moratorium. There is an exception process in place where a licensed provider may request an exception to the moratorium. Within that process exists language that directs the commissioner to evaluate the current capacity in the area the license is seeking to operate.
Ms. Grastrom, could I ask you to please wrap up?
One more point.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. 245D providers are also subject to the federally required home and community-based settings rule. This rule restricts a provider from opening or operating homes that share a property line. The purpose of this rule is to ensure that home and community-based settings do not have institutional qualities. Homes that were open before the rule went into place went through heightened scrutiny to ensure they were community-based, with all new homes required to meet these guidelines. I would just want to say communities are strongest when we welcome people of all abilities. Instead of restricting where community residential settings can exist, we encourage the legislature to focus on expanding housing options, supporting quality services, and promoting inclusive neighborhoods where everyone can belong. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Grafstrom. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. I think it's been painted pretty clearly today that the root cause of the issues that cities are experiencing is not being addressed today. It's very clear that people are just uncomfortable with high-density populations of people with higher needs. I encourage this legislature to bring forward bills that resource the people who live in our communities, our constituents. I also would ask that we do not bring maps to where vulnerable people live. I understand you said this is public information. So are in-home child care centers. And I think we would all be appalled if we gave maps to people of where vulnerable folks live. Lastly, I will say the appropriate process to follow if somebody feels that somebody is being abused, neglected, maltreated, or under financial exploitation, the appropriate method of reporting is the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, 1-844-880-1574. Again, the MARC, the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, is 1-844-880-1574. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Curran. With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 4144 be laid over for possible inclusion. And with that, we are adjourned.